90.3 FM, Fresh Air Community Radio. Hoka.
KFAI is proud to present Mark Sultan at the Turf Club on Monday, October 21st. Mark Sultan, also known as One Man Band Barbecue, is a cult figure, sorcerer, nutcase, and underrated gem. His legacy of LPs and 45s on various indie labels and his impressive list of rock and roll projects are an influential secret handshake, and that's just the way he likes it. Tickets for Mark Sultan can be found at the First Avenue website. Visit first-avenue.com for more details.
Support for KFAI comes from Pangea World Theater's presentation of Death and the Maiden, a political thriller by playwright Ariel Dorfman and directed by Ismali Khalidi. Death and the Maiden tackles themes of state violence, trauma, and the search for justice. Opening October 25th until November 2nd. PangeaWorldTheater.org to learn more.
Hello, Counterstories listeners. We have been doing this show in various formats for 10 years this year. In all those years, it has always been the four of us, myself, Halil Lee, Luz Maria Frias, Anthony Galloway, and Don Eubanks. However, we are sad to report that Don has passed away. He was our friend, he was a mentor, and a teacher, and he was our family member. In the weeks to come, as we take time to grieve, mend, and reflect on Don's life and his immense impact throughout the state, we will be re-airing some of Don's favorite episodes and topics.
This is Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Anthony Galloway, senior partner of Dendros Group and pastor of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth, Minnesota.
I'm Halili, owner of The Other Media Group and producer of Counter Stories.
And I'm Don Eubanks, associate of Dendros Group and member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians.
Luz Maria Frias couldn't be with us today, and I know she's going to be very, very, very remorseful at missing yet what something that has become one of our mainstays and actually a favorite of our listeners, and that is our grab bag episodes. We know often that when we get together with our peers, particularly in communities of color, conversations don't go in an ordered, sequential, linear way. Things are just going to go wherever they go. And so one of the reasons I love our grab bag episodes is because they feel more like what happens when we're sitting in the backyard with a couple slabs on the grill, you know, pontificating on the world. Now that we are growing in our consciousness, there's a whole lot more things that are going to come across the table that we're going to be able to look at with a critical lens. So let's jump right in. Recently, Lee, you sent us a review of the movie Prey. If you are unfamiliar with it, it's the latest in the Predator movie franchise. If you remember back to the days of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny Glover in the original Predator movies, this schmaltzy sci-fi classic that is one of my favorites, the classic series, now
at
has
a, at least a, that first one, Anthony.
At least that. Well, I will say the second one. Hey, there's something about being in Detroit, going toe to toe with the Predator, Danny Glover's old behind that just gave me smiles and chills. But anyway. The most recent movie takes place in 1719 United States and among the Comanche tribe, going toe-to-toe with the Predator Beast at this time. So we get to see kind of an old-school take on the Predator franchise. However, a reviewer, who names themselves, quote-unquote, the Hollywood scholar, gave a review that, before we even saw the movie, left a lot of our heads going, scratching, going, what? Because there's a lot of what was said in here that was problematic even before watching the movie. So let's dive right into that review, y'all. As we read that review, and the review was found in the Geeks and Gamers, and so if you want to go and take a look at it there, you can. But the review does a few things. It's very clear that the reviewer does not like the movie. But then we go on to refer to things, for one, referencing a Comanche squaw, saying that a child could have made this story, that it made absolutely no sense, and all these issues that they had because the story wasn't told in the way they might have told it, prompting many folks online to call yet again the fact that oftentimes white cisgender males who do these reviews are often do not like movies, especially involving folks of color, because they don't get it or it doesn't hit them in the way that is home or normal to themselves. So what came up with you from y'all when y'all were looking at this review?
I haven't seen the movie. It's not quite my genre. So a friend shared the review with me after, and we talked about this on another one of our shows, when Turning Red came out. There was a cis white movie reviewer who said it was terrible because it was unrelatable, an Asian girl in Toronto, that it was too unrelatable and that made it a bad movie. And so here we are again with another cis white male. He literally wrote, "This is one of the dumbest movies ever created." And he goes on and on about how terrible everything is and it's not historically correct. And so I was interested, and I looked up some other reviews, and there were good reviews. So I was like, huh, that's, you know, but really, of course, what took me immediately was his use of the slur. And there is an editor's note at the end of the article, and it says, "A staff member has brought to our attention," and I don't think it was a staff member, it was like a ton of community people, brought to our attention that the term squaw is considered a racist term for Native Americans in the modern day. It was used in this article in its historical context as a term for a Native American woman because the movie takes place in the 1700s, and we will not remove it. Now let me read the sentence. "Prey follows the story of Naru, a Comanche squaw who is repeatedly told she's better than everyone else in her community at everything except hunting."
It's also not true, but keep going.
I mean, when I read that, well, after wading through the first two paragraphs of his reaction to the movie, I thought, you know, who is this guy? And but then when he got to the description where he was actually talking about the movie, and he opened up with that sentence, and he opened up with the use of Comanche squaw, I literally stopped and thought, who the hell is this guy? And it, because the first two paragraphs, like you said, Hilly, were extremely, everything was negative. And then the whole entire piece was written from his tiny little perspective on, I don't know. I mean, it was hard to gauge other than, you know, he clearly didn't like the movie. But his interpretations of what he saw is what really bothered me, because yeah, he's infusing his white maleness on a cultural setting that he has no understanding about, no degree of knowledgeable anything about what was transpiring in that movie, because I've seen the movie. And, you know, it was, without giving away the plot or anything, the fact that they had a female Native American who kind of carried this movie in a genre we normally don't see Native American or people of color, for that fact, but especially Native Americans. We never see Native Americans portrayed in a genre like this, but portrayed in a historic mode where it was like, wow, right? Now, there was some give and take with the story and with what her role was within the tribe and how she was navigating around that, but his interpretation of that was to refer to her as this whiny individual. You know, I mean, it was like, when I read that part, I was going, you know, this guy clearly does not understand what was happening in his movie. Not at all. And go ahead, Anthony.
I need to add into there, you know, again, We're going to avoid spoiler alerts as we talk about this, but it's yet again an example of the tone deafness and the absence of context, as you said, and nuance, as you said. One of the things that he says in his article is that this mundane and slog of inconsistent language, because it swapped back and forth between English and Comanche with no mention. I just want to point out that there was no mention of the Europeans in the movie that were speaking French fur trader dialects of French. So exactly. They got so specific as to speak not just French, right, but French fur trader dialects going in and out of English. No conversation about that part of it.
None whatsoever.
Which to me was the most weird space. So this is 1719. So if you want to talk about historical space, yes, the Comanche are speaking English and having to and are bringing in some of those cultural elements. So this assumption that it's historically inaccurate because they should only be speaking Comanche that whole entire time, as if these folks aren't multilingual. Folks were picking up languages pretty consistently. It's only a modern convention in the United States that we're
Hold on. I have to jump in here because the way they did that in the movie was so that the audience could understand what they were talking about.
Exactly.
That's the only reason why they used English. There is a version of this film that is in total Comanche with English subtitles. So if you notice, and I'm not going to spoil the movie, but they were speaking Comanche. And then what they did for the audience is they switched to English. But they weren't speaking English because they knew how to speak English. The movie itself switched to English so the audience could follow.
You as the viewer needs to understand that they're actually speaking their language.
Hold on. I take the absolute point when they're just in the spaces where it's other Comanche folks. But in the exchange with the French fur traders, it was absolutely common at that time to default to English in spaces where you couldn't, where the French could speak, you know, Comanche, and Comanche couldn't speak French. English was definitely picked up as a language amongst folks to try to figure out how to communicate. And what you would get is this hodgepodge of both French, English, and indigenous languages. That is a real thing, as folks are trying to figure out how to speak languages. And it was funny because the French person who actually figured out how to communicate in that space, if you look real closely, they a little darker than the rest of their French friends, which was often used during those times, because folks who was forced more than anybody else to be multilingual. I actually think there was quite a bit of historical accuracy in that exchange.
He said everything should be in Comanche. Can you imagine him watching this if that was true? No, he would never watch this and review this movie. It would never even come on his radar if that was the way it is. Second, lots of movies do this. When these movies take place in other countries, so Isle of Dogs is a good example. The movie by Wes Anderson in 2018, one of my favorite movies, and it says right at the beginning. He knew he had to say this, I guess, was that everything has been translated to English, so that people know, like, okay, this takes place in a city in Japan. Why is everybody speaking English? It's because you just have to understand that that's what they're speaking. It's the same thing with movies with animals that speak, right? They go meow, meow, but then there's a voiceover for us viewers to understand what the meow, meow means. And, okay, my last point is...
certain movies get praised for it.
Yes. But the thing is, he kept saying it was historically inaccurate. But he doesn't tell us what was accurate then, because he himself does not know. He just assumes.
Well, you know, the problem...
Say that to every sci-fi show and film that tries to have a back-in-time component
exactly.
to it.
Exactly. Like, I mean, you know, when he was picking... I mean, he was really reaching to do a disservice to this film that he obviously did not like. But to reach, you know, I agree with you, Hilly. I'm reading this thing, and I'm thinking, you know, he's making these blatant statements about the inaccuracy. Although I do have to admit, even, you know, when I watched that film, there were some things that, you know, I know I'm watching this sci-fi film. I know it's taking place in our land, right? As the French and other Europeans are beginning to increase their number here and there's more interactions. So, but I think what threw me at first was when they first announced that they were Comanche. But I'm looking at how, you know, where they filmed this, and there was a lot of wooded area. There was some open area prairie, but there was a scene where there were some bison that had been killed and stripped of their fur, right? Skinned and then left to rot in the sun. And so, so of course, in my mind, I'm thinking, wait a minute, Comanche were down in the Southwest with the, you know, down there in New Mexico and Arizona. And I'm thinking, you know, and I'm sure bison may have got that far, but I don't remember a lot of wooded areas kind of like what I'm seeing in the movie. So, but, you know, I think they like many other tribes, probably followed the food source, and that food source would have brought them up maybe because with the interaction with these French voyeurs, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, them dudes were up here, you know, up here around Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, you know, hunting beaver and all that and interacting with the Ojibwe or whatever. How did they come across this Comanche tribe? So I'm just thinking, you know, but migration and all that, you know, and following, it could have happened.
To your point, you brought that point up earlier. I think it's an excellent point, right? At some point, in order to get the predator in there, that'd be a boring predator movie taking place in the great just the plains area. You need some woodland to have a good predator movie. I'm just saying.
So the predator's gonna hide somewhere.
But I think, you know, what this reviewer was missing, however, was the fact that it was with this tribe and with a young woman in a tribe attempting to do something that at that time period, and even up to now, women aren't seen or being prepared to be hunters. And so, and that's the premise of the movie, was this young Comanche woman who was doing all the things that traditionally and historically in that time, you know, women weren't playing the role of hunters, and she wanted to be a hunter. And so, and that's basically the premise of the movie, was her showing to her people that she could do it, which the reviewer called her a whiner.
Well, and that's the thing, and that stood out to me too on the gendered side of things, because he paints a picture as if her only reason for doing it is because she was told that she couldn't. And keep in mind, I want us to be clear that, you know, you can like this movie, dislike this movie. You know, we're not coming at whether or not he should have or shouldn't have liked the movie, but we're pointing out very specific things that were written in the review of it that make at least my BIPOC radar go up, because it marks of so many of these reviews that we have seen that just don't get don't get some of the things that we see and expect that all of this movies and all of these things should be in service to one myopic monocultural view of the world. And that's where we're calling, you know, shenanigans on. I have to add into this, right? If we want to look at some stories that are told to us in bogus way, we now have to keep unpacking stories that we have. Some of us may have grown up with, some have not. Many of you may be familiar with the story of Emmett Till. This may seem like a forced digression, but hear me out, okay? Because in the same way that many folks are tone deaf in the way that they review our movies, even our actual historical stories get some of the same treatment, where we actually have the facts and the details, and we still can't get no justice even in those real lived stories. Recently, the woman who falsely accused and pointed out Emmett Till, and was the cause, right? I guess white supremacy would say would be the cause, but she was definitely one of the tools who accused Emmett Till and lied about Emmett Till, lied in court, was recently brought up on charges. And the grand jury, it says the grand jury declines to indict Carolyn Bryant Dunham, the woman whose accusations led to the murder of Emmett Till. So even in our own real historical stories, we're having to continually deal with how those stories are told and retold, and what do we do about what comes forward in them. You brought this in front of us, but you know what comes up for you when you see that she wasn't charged or the grand jury decided not to indict, which to me makes sense, but I want to hear your perspective.
Right. I mean, the first thing you think of is like, what? That doesn't make any sense. What she said and did caused this young boy his life. When I read that the charges against her was kidnapping and manslaughter, to me in my brain, that didn't make sense. Right. She made false claims that ended a person's life, and she lied in court. In court, she described in detail what happened, or what quote unquote happened. And just because it's been a long time, she still needs to be held responsible for that. And so the charges of kidnapping and manslaughter, I agree that, you know, it's hard to charge her with that.
Well, no, I don't know, Hilly. I mean, my reaction was the same. I was pissed that this individual was not indicted. But when I looked at what they were trying to indict her on, I questioned why they brought those charges forward, mm-hmm. kidnapping and manslaughter. Because, you know, while she was definitely an accessory to that, right? Because it was her husband and others who kidnapped Emmett, beat him and then shot him and then dumped his body in the river. And I'm sure she was well aware of what happened. It was the fact that she perjured herself, right? And so a part of me, you know, I think often in our communities, we want to see our tormentors, our oppressors, the folks who are killing us, we want to see them held accountable. We already know that a jury in Mississippi acquitted those individuals because I think less than a year later, they admitted to killing Emmett in a Life magazine interview, right? They admitted to killing Emmett Till. No one has been held accountable for his death. I think she's the last surviving member. The fact that they actually found a warrant that was issued for her arrest shortly after it happened, and that resurfaced, begs that some kind of justice happen. And so were the charges mismatched? You know, I think they were also. I mean, and I don't know what was presented in the grand jury trial, so it's hard to get into the specifics, but I know it just deals another blow to our psyche. The fact that we know this person's guilty.
Well, there's a couple of things there, and it's
right?
really unfortunate. Well, something, yeah. And it's unfortunate that Luz couldn't be with us to like give us the fine point.
Yes.
But there's a CNN article where a cousin who witnessed Emmett Till's abduction, Reverend Wheeler Parker Jr., said that, you know, they kept their promise by bringing this latest piece of evidence before the grand jury. This outcome is unfortunate. This is a quote in an article by CNN, but predictable news. And I want to point out that to your point, Don, you know, if you're going to it bring the grand jury around something, you can't bring it around stuff that has statutes of limitation. So unfortunately, you know, I think the and Luz will have to come back behind us and correct this. But I think it's 5 years for perjury, in depending on when you talk about. So there's certain things that folks, unfortunately, just by the nature of time, can get away with. There's some that you have a lot more time to be able to bring up. But this also speaks to, for
but
me,
but doesn't that vary by state, though, Anthony?
It does vary by state. I'm being specific to Mississippi.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, I'm being specific to Mississippi. But this particular area.
But there was a warrant. Right. There was a warrant.
This is one of those insidious things that white supremacy has hid itself behind, right? I can do just enough to push the mechanisms in place, but as long as it's diffuse enough, where I can technically not be proven of this one of being the one who pushed the button, but I set up all of the scenarios in which the button can be pushed all across America. How many people mm-hmm. have been lynched? Because
well, wait a minute. I thought we were talking about Emmett Till and not. What's currently happening?
I see what you did there. Right.
I'm sorry. You know yep. me.
Keeping it 100.
I'm just saying what you just described there is what we are currently dealing with.
I would say it's even happening in our classrooms. How many times have I had black children, indigenous children, come to me and I have to work with their parents and walk with them into a school because somebody has been picking on this student over and over again, relentlessly, in all the ways that can't mm-hmm. be seen or can't be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. Or I didn't mean that they couldn't afford it. I just brought up the question of whether or not they could afford their lunch. And they just got mad at me, even though I've done that every single year, fomenting all of this stuff. And so then when the kid mm-hmm. finally puts, you know, comes to a head and says, you ain't gonna do this no more, and stands up to you, now you play the victim. Right? I have mm-hmm. seen the same mechanisms happen even in school. So when you talk about bringing it to today, I'm absolutely. And I think this is the hard piece. How do you hold folks accountable? And we want to use the legal system to do it, but the legal system has limits. They got to work within a very specific set of parameters, mm-hmm. even though we know the dog whistle, we know the tactics that can't be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt in court, but you know for a fact how it tees itself up to do what it does.
And you know, I think what makes it frustrating for us is that we just went through Aubrey's the mm-hmm. men that killed Aubrey mm-hmm. down in Georgia, right? In Brunswick, Georgia, were sentenced in federal court, right? So we have a situation where finally we saw some justice against right. white men killing mm-hmm. a black male. That played out in court. We sat through those hearings. They were convicted. They're guilty. But for Emmett, this has been going on. This happened, what, in 1955? I was born in 1954, probably about 5-6 months before this happened. So this has been happening my entire lifetime. And we still, it saddens me that there may not ever be anyone held accountable mm-hmm. for that.
There may be some of us in the United States that are growing to a space of being so fragile to the notion that somehow I might need to do something different, that everything seems to be a fight and I want to dismiss all of this complex and nuance and think it's going to be some hard thing that I have to, as you please said, somebody told you, you know, do you turn it off ever? I've now come to a space that Miriam Makeba pointed out for us. Miriam Makeba, well-known South African singer, said, "I look at an ant and I see myself, a native South African endowed by nature with a strength much greater than my size, so I might cope with the weight of racism that crushes my spirit." We have to remember that we are also endowed with the strength of those same ancestors to get through day by day. I'm Anthony Galloway, pastor of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth, Minnesota, and senior partner at Dendros Group.
I'm Halili, owner of The Other Media Group and Counter Stories producer.
And I'm Don Eubanks, associate at Dendros Group and member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians.
Keep your head up, keep your strength up. This is Counter Stories. This has been Counter Stories, a co-production of the Counter Stories crew, the Other Media Group, and AMPRS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit counterstories.com.